can get people to get along, to communicate, to come to agreements.
You serve in an apprenticeship program, and you've been there and working for 4 or 5 years. You ought to at least walk out of that with an associate's degree.
Hi, this is Dr. Bud Pearson. Welcome to Oregon Crossroads. And Oregon Crossroads is a place where we talk about freedom and prosperity. Because when people are free to be who they are and what they are and do what they want to do in a free way, prosperity follows. And today, I have another great guest, a favorite person of mine, a really outstanding citizen in the Salem area, Jody Hack. I think many of you already know her. Jody, thanks for talking to me today.
Thanks for having me.
And I love having Jody here because, number one, she has a medical background. You know, I'm a doctor, and I love people who have medical backgrounds. And Jody was a CEO of a medical clinic, and then she moved toward the education and grant writing and resources for the school district. And finally, she ended up running for state legislator and was successful, yay, and represented District 19 very well. Rapidly moved up in leadership in the Republican Party, and I actually talked to some people about why that was, and they said, well, Jody can get people to get along, to communicate, to come to agreements, and she's, I hate to use this word in this era, but a deal maker, and I don't mean that in a negative way, because there's a lot of negative connotations around that, but as a deal maker. And then, sadly, for the citizens of Oregon, she was stolen away by the Oregon Home Builders Association. Great for them. And she's now working on in a very important area. And that area, of course, is housing. And we know, probably better than many states, is that we need to have housing and shelter for all our citizens. And the home builders have to build that, actually. And beyond that, though, housing and shelter can go way beyond the basics and can be great centers of pleasure in people's lives. And it's an important part of our economy, probably about 5-10% of our GDP, probably closer to 10% of our state GDP is involved in the remodeling and building trades, and probably about 10% of our employment. So it's a huge part of our economy. It needs to be robust and successful for society to go to where it needs to go to, and no better representative to help the process than Jody Hack. And so, Jody, thank you again. And let me just start off by saying, as a leader of this organization and dealing with remodelers and builders, where are we in Oregon in that process? Where is the group of people that build our housing in terms of their happiness, success, challenges?
You know, I think everybody's feeling the stress of meeting the need. And our builders are no different than anybody else. They see it every day. We see homelessness. We see people needing homes. And the lack of building permits that we've had over the last few years has put us in a hole. And now we're in a catching up pattern. So I think, you know, while they feel the stress of that, they're also really thankful and happy that they're working and that they have as much demand on them as they do, especially coming out of the recession. That was really difficult on a lot of our folks. So I think that they're pretty happy with the market. There's some frustration. You know, we've got some local barrier issues that I'm sure you and I will talk about further as we go into this lack of supply. So while there's some frustration there, I think there's also some really excited folks and some really hardworking people that are out there trying to make sure that we have enough housing for all Oregonians across the state.
So I'm hearing right away, so you're talking about lack of permitting and frustration on being able to do the work. So can you expand on that a little bit?
You know, so I spent the first 6 months in this position traveling the state, and I really wanted to know the perspective of our builders. I don't live in it, and I needed to understand what barriers are you finding? How do we address the issue that we've got so many folks that don't want to see expansion into the UGB, and so how do we build everything that we've got within the UGB, and then how do we have conversations of moving outward? Well, time and time again, it didn't matter if I was talking to a builder in the city of Portland or I was talking to a builder on the far east side of our state in Hermiston. Many of the similarities came back to lack of, you know, at the city level, they didn't have the staffing oftentimes. So the far east side, you could have a city that was slow in permitting because they didn't have the staff. They don't have a lot of the infrastructure and places that need to be built out, the process that you have to go through to do that. whether it be DEQ, so on the state level to the local level, there's just barrier after barrier. The cost of SDC fees. While it's different for different parts of the state, Portland, you know, their SDC fees are outrageously priced, and that affects affordability to how do you develop a subdivision when it takes you 5 years to get a plot plan. And who you know, that cost goes on the builder, which then gets passed to the consumer, which then affects affordability to the Far East or even the Medford area, where if they do want to expand, how do you get roads where you need to get them? And they haven't charged as much in SDC fees for infrastructure, so they don't have that pot of money to do the work that needs to be done. So a lot of frustration on the local barrier side. And to be honest, too, the NIMBY situation, not in my backyard, when you have a developer that or a builder that goes in and they say, this lot allows for 5 units, and I want to be able to build 5 units. And the minute they apply for that permit, you've got somebody that comes in and says, well, we're going to appeal. And just the intent to appeal throws that into, we've got to hire lawyers, slows the process up, and oftentimes builders will just say, you know what, it's just not worth it for me, and they'll walk away from a project.
There's an interesting book out by Phil Howard of The Common Good, and he talks about the bureaucracy versus democracy. And he says it's not so much a red, blue, or R&D issue, it's about the bureaucracy and the complexity of getting things done. And he was commenting that in an analysis done that for every 6 years you're delayed, you double the cost. And so if you look at a 5-year delay, you basically double the cost of your development, and that's just phenomenal. So I'm going to use that to segue a little bit into the affordable housing issue. And my observation is the attempts at affordable housing to this point have primarily been build it the way we can, which is generally not too affordable, and then subsidizing it into affordability for the lucky few. So the question about affordable, so we'll talk about affordable to build housing. What's your sense, if we took, let's maybe go three areas, we kind of have the numbers in your head, it's not exact or anything, but I'm trying to get a sense. So let's say you're out in the Eastern Oregon, and or less developed areas, and you want to have, and a developer or builder wants to obtain a lot, and so you have the cost of the lot, and then you have the cost of the second part is the fees or infrastructure to allow you to build that. What is there a sense of, let's say the cheapest parts of the state, what that would be, the cheapest parts? Are we talking about $50,000, $100,000, $150,000? Any sense?
I would say
Cheapest, the best, the easiest.
That's tough, because again, it depends on what they have to do to get to it. So what's the infrastructure mm-hmm. that has to happen to get there?
And do the builders have to build that?
Oh, yeah. Okay. And what happens on the utility side? Is there power already there? You got to get power in, the conduit in. I think I would probably be remiss in having the correct calculation.
Okay.
I can tell you that fees vary from $60,000 for an SDC, that's just to connect, mm-hmm. to probably as low as $8,000 or $10,000.
Okay, all right.
So very, very vastly different.
Okay.
And then you can look at a cost of a lot. Could mm-hmm. be $150,000 on one part of the state, and it could be as low as $60,000 or $50,000 on another. But I think on the rural side, the challenges in that are everything it takes to get you to be able to even build.
So you might get to $60,000, $50,000 lot and $10,000 for your connection, but then all the work you have to do to bring that in.
Right.
So you're probably approaching six figures just to start there.
Easily.
And then on the other issues, you're multiples of six figures.
Yes.
And most people would say an affordable house is $150,000, $200,000.
And if you're affordable to build, probably $300,000.
Correct.
Is a starter home, $300,000 to $350,000.
Okay.
So,
that's the kind of the sense we have to get. So what it sounds like what we need to do is, again, can you come up with affordable land? And again, there's ways to do that as you think about maybe having a little flexibility on opening up land, and there's a long history
supply and demand.
Yep. And then maybe get some help to the builders in terms of the infrastructure needs outside of their immediate development. Because when you're charged for that, that makes it unaffordable. And it's very interesting because I've been here for 25 years now. And it really, it's interesting how it favors the haves and the established. Mm-hmm. And really to have vitality in a society, you do make it so it's low cost and affordable for the young and the new startups. But when you create this expensive bureaucracy, they never have a chance. And if you're a have, it just helps you. It's interesting when you think of it that way. Let's move a little bit to labor. Are the home builders doing okay with their workforce? Because a home is only as good as the people who have the skill to build it. And so where are they at with labor and workforce?
We are feeling the crunch just like everybody else is. We need more workforce. And time is money. Mm-hmm. And the longer it takes you to complete a project, the more it costs. And there aren't a lot of folks out there. And again, it goes back to the skill. Even if you do hire them, oftentimes they don't have the skills to do the work. So it's so important that we find ways to grab young people, in projects with the CTE work and all those things. We're absolutely supportive of that. But we're feeling the same crunch that many folks are. There's just not enough.
And is the, just trying to get a little bit away from that, but I'm not going to be completely away, is the immigration battle about that? Is the general sense of the home builders that to have a clear and defined immigration policy that could be helpful in workforce needs, could be helpful? Is that a
I would say, statement? I don't want to speak for the national folks, mm-hmm. but I would say on a national level, mm-hmm. I think that everyone would like to see some assurity on that.
I agree with that. Good. And then the next thing is, what about like the tariff struggle and all that in terms of, supply in and all that? So we have issues of wood products coming in, which is always kind of laughable to me because we live in Oregon and we have more trees than anything else. But somehow homegrown seems to be hard to do. We do import wood for building. And then the whole issue of supplies, equipment, and things like that.
Our folks have felt some of the impacts with the tariffs for sure. And again, it goes back to the overall affordability side of things. Mm-hmm. And the wood is very frustrating for our folks. And it's tough because it's hard to, the market only allows for so much. Mm-hmm. The market dictates. And when that happens with the tariffs, it does affect the affordability and the cost of the home. And that has had some impact on our guys. The national folks have really taken a deep dive into the tariff situation and are have been very active players in D.C. over that issue.
So if we're going to tear down barriers to helping really make housing, I would say more affordable and to allow us to have the variety of housing that I think people would like. We really don't want to have a monolithic society with monolithic housing, yep. One size fits all. I think that's so against what we are as a people and as a culture. But if we're going to start to take pragmatic steps, how do you think we should do that? How do we have a better future for Oregon home builders?
I appreciate the fact that you're looking at it through that lens, because mm-hmm. People do need choice, and a one size fits all does not work. So I think there's a combination of making sure that we have broken down the barriers and found every way possible that we can build on what we have, whether that's infill, whether that's a skinny lot in Portland to a corner duplex in Eastern Oregon. That all needs to be built out. That's what it's there for, and that's what we should be doing. Then we also need to be looking in the areas, especially in the Portland metro area, and there are a lot of others, that the potential of expansion needs to happen. Those conversations have to happen because people still want a single-family home with a two-car garage and a yard. Not everybody wants walkable, livable space. So I think the injustice that we can do to Oregonians is to say that there's a one-size-fits-all, because there truly is not. And again, it goes right back to the democracy issue. Mm-hmm. Folks should have some choice, and part of that process should be that we don't just say it's got to be one way. So I would say a combination of both of those things, but we truly do need to have some conversation about expanding the UGB. And I grew up in Eastern Oregon. I mean, I'm from a ranching and farming community and family, and I understand some of the angst in doing that, but you can't have the population growth that we've had in the state of Oregon and not begin to have those conversations.
So to help, and again, to help Eastern Oregon, which I traveled around and you have a living experience, so would it be helpful to get infrastructure? Would that be a helpful focus so that you can build and you can, in other words, you don't have to pay for the infrastructure, the builder wouldn't have to pay?
those folks, yeah, definitely need some help on the infrastructure side. They also need, you know, they've got this methodology that they use to calculate the needs for housing, and that came back to Goal 10, which is what we look at to say what types of housing do we need. And what's happened is, especially on the east side and some of the smaller communities, they don't have the capacity within their local government municipalities to say, we can do this work. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes they don't really know what they even need. So we've got to come alongside and figure out how we help the smaller local municipalities and even some of the larger ones understand and do those housing needs analysis work that mm-hmm. is so desperate to telling us what it is that we have or we don't have. But certainly on the Eastern Oregon side, I would say infrastructure is a necessity, because you could drive 10 miles to get to a new subdivision and need roads to get there.
So with the, if you look at my favorite example is Germany, because I'm half German, they have an elaborate program of training people in the trades and for manufacturing jobs. So it would be career technical education training would be the beginning. And in fact, they'll test people and kind of fit them in. I think the American way is more test people and present their aptitude and then encourage them. Mm-hmm. That's a much better way, so people have that choice. But again, it would be, CTE would be the start. Then there would be a lot of training and learning from the actual people that do the work, and then eventually you'd be, you know, freed up calmly after a 6 to 10 year apprenticeship. I mean, they're serious about it. And that way those jobs are respected and they're well paid already right now. Do you think there's a will or a way to kind of rally, you know, our cultural elements, because we've so denigrated the trades mm-hmm. and manufacturing, that kind of work, that we've gotten what we've created, which is people don't want to do it. Do you think anyone could take on that, or industry, or, you know, kind of lead the charge?
For sure, an apprenticeship program, a lot of our folks are already doing those and partnering with the CTE groups. I think even to further that conversation, would be finding a way to say, if you serve in an apprenticeship program, you ought to have a degree. Because let's face it, most families, most parents want their kids to have a college degree. And the trades don't provide for that. And you're right, we've created a culture that said, that's bad. If you don't have a college education, it's bad. So why is it that we have all these, again, barriers around, if you serve in an apprenticeship program and you've been there and working for 4 or 5 years, you ought to at least walk out of that with an associate's degree.
Fabulous. All right.
And if we can do that, I think we'll make some strides to getting more young people into the industry.
So it's all about the people. It's all about getting the right people involved. We have a dynamic, superb leader, Jody Hack.
Who is
the right person at the right time to do what we want to have done. And that's going to be education and training of our children so that they can do the jobs and create the great housing and homes. Someone who has the sophistication to work with the legislature and local government, and again, has the right mindset to really try to get the job done and focus on what we need to focus on. You're focusing on the people, the citizens of Oregon, and provide them with, yes, basic housing, but housing that's a huge variety of housing that's well beyond basic if they so desire, because that's about freedom and that's about prosperity. And again, Jody Hack, thanks for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having
Thank
me.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Whenever new laws are created, someone has to monitor them. It's going to cost extra. And then there we go.
All those levels.
Yeah.
All those levels. I was around when there was affordable housing.
Yeah.
And there certainly weren't all these people that had to be fed off of it. Scam kind of. It's kind of pretty. You're going to be okay with background noise?
Yeah, those mics, they don't allow everything behind you. So, all right, so let me get this just a tad closer to you.
So we have, we're going to have, 20 minutes roughly?
Yep, about 20.
And we'll just take this where it goes, really. I just want to get a sense at the end of this of, my hope is, we'll talk a little bit about the hopes of Latinos. Mm-hmm. The weirdness of there only being one race, but yet we divide ourselves. The next one, just what it's like to be, you're American born and stuff, and you're American, and you're an Oregonian, but still, you know, what does it feel like because you're not in the majority, and it isn't the same. Because I talked to some about you, Chinese, the same thing, you know, the same thing. Just get some flavor for that. I'm not trying to look at pick or anything. I'm just trying to get a sense of letting people honestly discuss with the idea that as a result of this, will people think about things differently and maybe make things better? Yeah, I really didn't. there is really not an iota more. I don't have an agenda here. I'm just trying to get interesting people, and I think it's an important and pertinent topic.
So, 100%.
That's all.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All righty.
Okay, count us down.
Yep, we're going to go live in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hi, this is Dr. Bud Pierce, and today we're on Oregon Crossroads, and I have a great guest today, Mr. Jose Gonzalez, a good friend of mine. Jose, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure, my friend.
And again, on Oregon Crossroads, we're talking about all manner of things that are important and interesting to our society. And with that focus on freedom, it's so important to be free to be who you are and what you are and to live the way that you want to live. And to be prosperous. Prosperity is very important because only by being prosperous are you really able to be free. And today I really want to focus on the issues of, a little bit on the issues of race, to be frank about it. And this is something we struggle as human beings. Many of us know in our hearts there's only one race, the human race. All are equal in the eyes of God, should be equal in the eyes of man. And pretty good by law, we have equality in America. My wife's a Chinese American. Jose is a Latino American, born in Oregon. My wife was born in the United States. And it's interesting, though, for people in the majority to talk to people who aren't in the majority but who are equal in Americans. So what is their experience? How are we doing? And how could things be better? So I'll just frame it there and quit talking and turn it over to Jose, who's just a wonderful man, great father, businessman. He has a realty business called Tu Casa. If you want a great realtor in the Salem-Keizer area, the greater Salem-Keizer area, please feel free to call him. And with that, I'll open up to Jose. And Jose, how are things?
You know, things are good.
Okay.
But I think just being amongst you is always a great experience, you know. So thanks for the invite.
Sure.
You know, believe me, one of the questions I asked when I was younger is, okay, my parents are from Mexico City. Back then, they were undocumented. Now they're American citizens, but why Salem? Why the Willamette Valley? Why Woodburn? Why are we here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you're right. Being born here, you know, I always told people, in my home, I live like a Mexican. And then outside my home, I live like an American. Because it was night and day. And so, you know, that was tricky. It was
mm-hmm.
tricky to navigate that. And, you know, I'm blessed and privileged to have made it through. A lot of my friends did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think it was seeing that, my friends, family, and sort of their experience here in this area. This is the only place I've ever lived and only place I will ever live. And, yeah, if I can share some tips and just seeing it from my, you know, 10-year-old eyes, 5-year-old eyes, you know, just I'll share anything you can talk about. Yeah.
So many of us are concerned about the wealth gap, the prosperity gap. And I'll just tell you an observation I made of my practice. So we have 100-plus employees, 4 sites, Salem, McMinnville, Woodburn, and Silverton. And so we have wonderful employees. We're in the people business. When you're taking care of patients, you're in the people business. When you're real estate business, you're in the people business. Whatever business you're in the people business. And those soft skills that we've learned through the years that have served us well. So when we post a $20 an hour job, which is a medical assistant, we have a variety of applicants, including Latinos.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a number of great Latino medical assistants, actually a good number. And everyone I think that's ever applied, we probably hire. But a great employee, he's done great, part of the family, wonderful. Then we have, the next step up is we pretty much have $40 an hour nursing employees. And there we have noticeably, and these just open applications. It's not word of mouth. It's open applications. And it's out there online in different ways and boards and stuff, employment boards. And we get less Latino applicants. But we hired like every one of them. They're great nurses. We love to have them. We want more. Then we hire into the nurse practitioner PA. And we have now 8. We started with 1. Never had an applicant that wasn't Caucasian. Most of them are women. And that's the $80 job, our job. And it was benefits. And now we're moving up to the physicians, and we're getting ready to hire another physician. That's the highest pay. We finally, I was on the East Coast, and we had a trainee who was finishing in Florida, or Venezuela, so a Latino, very interested in bringing him out. Brought him out, wooed him, winded him, dined him out. We were competing with New York, and we lost. So, what do we do? You know, as we've talked about in the past, I think it's great you know, look all through our economy, and you look at the Latino workers, and they're fabulous, and everybody wants them, but I want them as my fellow doctors. I want them as my PAs. I want them as my nurses. I want them in the Supreme Court. I want, and we have on Supreme Court, I know that, but you kind of get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
What do we do? And what are we not doing to make it happen? Because these are smart, hardworking individuals that we need to get them fully involved in the economy, or we're not going where we need to go.
You know, I think you're taking up about a couple of things. One is wealth creation. Another one is opportunity. You know, and I think so. Let's talk in general.
Okay,
this is not
sure.
every this is not
sure.
every Latino, but
sure. Sure.
But in general, you know, when I ask myself why Oregon, why is our family here? It was really because of the Bracero program. It was because of the need for farm labor.
Mm-hmm,
so really, Woodburn, Hubbard were the hearts of the initial starts of the Latino community. Back then, it was the Latinos from the Texas area. Then it became Mexicans that came up from California, and it was farm work.
Mm-hmm.
That's what started it. That's why Willamette Valley is what it is, because of our agriculture, and it's still at the heart of our community. That's where our heart is. The Latino community is the farm worker, the campesino. So the children of campesinos and the grandchildren, right? So as they're going out into the world, into applying at these offices, they're going to get into that position and look around and say, what do I do here? Who's here to support me that I can ask, that I can trust, to deal with some of these things that my parents never dealt with? Let me put it this way. When I was growing up, anything we got in English, a manual, an application, it was Jose, the 6-year-old Jose, 10-year-old, 12-year-old. Parents didn't do that. They still call me to this day, right? So can you imagine when I got my first office job or management career, I actually couldn't go to my parents after third grade as far as helping me at school. So now you're in an office culture, medical field, something completely new. Who do they bounce? Who are they going to have, you know how they say, the water
mentor.
Cooler?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, who's going to be there? Even a mentor, let's just say a partner, just...
Mm-hmm.
Someone they can talk to talk about things that they might not know that they're how to deal with, and so they retreat. Or like, now, who doesn't want to make more money, right? But at the same time, when you have, like, my mom would always say, Jose, look, in Mexico, some of the poorest people are the happiest. You know, so money isn't always considered happiness. It's the American dream here, right? It's what we achieve for. But a lot of people, they're happy at a certain level, because they can go home, because they know it's more responsibility, and they're going to get more stressed out. Or, you know what, let me make what I can make, and I'm going to go spend time with my family. You know, so I think it's two different things, but like I said, if we see this in banking, a lot of tellers at Wells Fargo, at certain banks, you start going up in the ranks, it disappears.
Right.
And it's for that same reason. It's just, there's not enough people, they don't know that, or the companies, business owners don't know that they're going to have a special training as they go up the ranks, something to support them in their family. So in other words, what load are they, what support are they carrying in their home? Are they, like a lot of people here, their parents can't drive. So guess who's driving them? Those employees. You know, guess who's translating? Guess who's spending time with them? So they don't have the ability to keep moving forward because they're helping their family, you know.
So it sounds like, in a way, it's evolutionary and it's happening, but it's not happening at the pace that those of us who are impatient would like it.
Well, yeah,
happen.
You
want
to give
opportunity. And
our
lives are limited. Really, to say we want to see it, you know, we have a short period of time that we say, darn it, the beginning of our life, it was one way, and I grew up in a very segregated time.
Yeah.
In many ways, legal segregation, and sexism was illegal,
yeah,
and everything. And now all the laws are off, but darn it, you want to see the fruits of that victory,
yeah,
and you don't see it yet. But
yeah,
again, what you're really saying is it's happening. And I would have to say, if you really step back and think about it, you know, we are seeing success. So people are moving up, and there are all kinds of successes. Let me ask you this question, which is another little bit of a hard one. I think it's valuable to take on the hard questions with friends. So about 500,000 Latinos in the state out of 4 million, something like that. 12%+ of our population, 25% of our children in school. So that's going that way. And we have the undocumented, it's illegal, whatever you want to call it, the word is. But that's a minority. That's 1 out of 6, 1 out of 7. So, and 2/3 of the Latinos are born here. So you have this big group of people that are legal and fine and born here. Is there ever the sense that you get picked on because of the relatively small number of people that we seem to be fighting over in our culture and can't figure out, you know, how to not so much solve the problem, but how to that come to solution. Is that you feel that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, especially at our office. Our office has been here in Salem for 23 years, and believe me, too bad we couldn't save some of those voicemails. We'd get to the office and they were just in our voicemail. It affects us in many ways. One of them is our friends and family that are in those situations and the fear that they still live. So all of us are really connected to somebody that's in that situation, sometimes multiple times. And then we deal with our clients. Some of our clients have had those situations in their family. And then, of course, whenever there's, whenever Latinos are in the media, locally, whatever it may be, that term gets thrown in right away. So no matter what anybody does, I could be here, I could even be from Spain. But just because my name sounds like this, they'll connect me. And we do get those slurs. I mean, I'm here today because I'm not afraid. I've never was.
I agree. I know.
And I've been able to overcome. I actually feel sorry for people that don't. But it does. I mean, any Latino here, any minority person in this situation is going to feel it locally. And I think everywhere, globally. I think everywhere. And actually, going back, we're in my circles, but I actually feel like I'm the majority.
Mm-hmm.
Where am I?
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Very good. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I've talked about this when I had my little run, and I've written about this, and talking about immigration reform.
Yeah.
So let's we'll take that on as because again this is we're going to talk about the big issues here, and I've written about this, and I talked about a pathway to citizenship for DACA.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about a legal status for the people who've been here part of our society, and give a legal status. I've talked about having immigration match workforce needs. I think that's fair to bring people in. And as kind of, and if you look at that, that is the plan of President Bush.
Mm-hmm.
That is the plan of President Obama. That is the plan of the Gang of Eight of senators.
Sure.
It seems that many reasonable people look at that and say that's where we need to go to help the freedom and prosperity of our society, because people that don't have a legal status to be here certainly aren't free, and they're afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And the prosperity of our society is diminished when people aren't free to act and behave in a free manner and in their own best interest. So what would you say about, is that kind of the thinking, or what are you thinking, or what is the thinking from the Latino community's broad? I mean, you're going to have people that are all over the place because it's not, it's not homogeneous. It's just like any other community. What's your thought?
Well, in my world, there's a term my parents used to say, but now I really understood what it means in the last 5 or 10 years, and it's seguir adelante, which means keep moving forward.
Okay.
And I've heard it now in so many situations, the worst of the best situations, and then they'll say seguir adelante. We got to keep going forward.
Okay.
You know, so those, I mean, I think everybody's waited for it. Whether it happens or not, we're not waiting for it. We're moving forward, right, no matter what it takes. Now, I think immigration is so complicated because we just pack on all these things. Language. I have to push number one for English. People throw that in there. You know, after 9/11, immigration was undocumented. People were mixed with terrorists. Now it's linked, those two terms. And then driver's licenses. Now they're going to vote. You know, like there's all these things that they're sort of connecting. When really I think the immigration issue, it should be something that's reviewed on a regular basis because our economic needs change.
Correct.
You know, and then things are going on around us that we should sort of think about. You know, and we do need it for a healthy economy. We need people coming in. That's just how it is. You know, so we're going to need people coming into our community, willing to be invest in our community. So we need that, but improper planning, so there's not enough schools, there's not enough chairs. That's not their fault. That's people locally that don't have a vision to how to build a city and not build hundreds of apartment complexes near a school that's already overcrowded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that has nothing to do with people coming here to try to, you know, do what I think everybody's. I mean, you're either an undocumented, you're most people here are immigrants other than our native people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so everybody's coming here for the same reason. But I think we're mixing all these things together. And it's not until someone just sort of steps back and just says, let's get a few things done, let's take baby steps, but let's make changes little by little, instead of trying to get the big package. I think that's one of the issues we have, is we're trying to do too much, and it's going to be difficult. There's just so many interests, and there's so many things added to it that aren't connected.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. education and training is a great economic equalizer. Mm-hmm. So you have children. How old are they?
So I have four.
Yeah.
24, yeah. 21, 13, and 9.
Okay.
Yeah.
All public school educated?
Yes.
Okay. So what's your view of public school education for Latino students? Is it much different than any than students in general? Are there challenges over time, as you described? Are they getting better now? Is it worse? And what are your sense of? Because I'm a janitor's kid, grew up outside of Air Force Base, and had a solid public education. It wasn't anything special, but it was solid, and that allowed me to go to the local university and made my life, really. It got me out of a blue-collar family into a white-collar existence, which is nice, and I always appreciate it. I just say that. I appreciate it immensely. But what about, what's the status of education, would you say, for... It's hard to... There are Latino students that are the finest private schools. I understand that. I get that. But let's just talk about big picture.
Yeah. No, and I think, I don't know if education... I mean, education is still one of the keys, but it's not the only one. You know, especially when there's, as the economy, whether it's growing or not, but when I look and I see all these people graduating from college, I'm thinking, wow, there's another 1 million people jumping into the workforce, right? So that degree that maybe you had or the people around you got, it's not going to go the same way for them. And even just to get at the cost, let's not even deal with the cost of it. So even the same opportunity is going to be a little more difficult because just of the competition, you know. But also, I don't know, public education, I think, to me, it's always been still at the heart. I mean, it's up to our family. It's up to what my wife and I do with them before and after school. That's really, whatever they learn there, I'm talking to them and I'm trying to say, okay, here's how you can take these issues. You know, here's how you can work through this. This is how it's going to fit in real life. You know, so I'm trying to guide them regardless of where and what they're learning. You know, so I'm not going to depend on that. You know, if you're going to say something, let's say, if you're going to be, we're going to talk about some specifics, the local Latino community, then there's some things that people sometimes aren't aware of, like I mentioned earlier. You know, if you aren't able to, you have to drag your parents to school, and then you got to do this, or you got to do all these extra things, those are the things that affect the student outside of class, in the class. You know, so those are the kind of things that you have to be aware of, whether it's bullying, whether it's not having your dad to go to and help you with your essay. You know, those all these little things that aren't necessarily because they're Latino, but it's because there's a lack of a connection. You know, the gap between my dad and I is huge. My son isn't as much. You know, and just, but between my dad and I, we just lived two different lives.
Yeah. The good news is 10,000 baby boomers are retiring each day. Mm-hmm. So therefore, there'll be lots of opportunities.
Are they?
They are.
Yeah.
It's an amazing number I'm in that generation.
Yeah.
So we're watching it. And so that's, again, the impetus for well-trained citizens at all levels and robust immigration. You look at it's interesting, look at a society like Japan, wonderful people, hardworking.
Yeah.
No one wants to immigrate there. I think within a few years, Tokyo will be 20% unpopulated in terms of their housing because there's no people who live there.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you're generally, when you get a aging society,
mm-hmm.
you'd love to bring in young people who are enthusiastic and working and can take your society forward. So we're nearing the end of our time here, and I guess I would ask you this question. If there's one thing that you would say to society in general, it's all of society, to help our Latino citizens to have better, more successful lives,
mm-hmm.
what should we be thinking about?
You know, first of all is listen to stories.
Okay.
Listen to stories and then expect the best. You know, I think a few people in my life expected the most out of me. In other words, get out of my way. You know, just believe in me and get out of my way. I mean, if I want to say it bluntly. Because that's the thing is, when you don't expect much out of people, it's what you're going to get. You know, but in my career, there was a moment where I was given a management position, and it wasn't my direct boss.
Mm-hmm.
It was his boss that sort of said, give him a chance. And that made the difference in my life, actually. That one person that I had never met, but based on the feedback he was getting, he went down the line and said, you better give this young kid a chance.
Excellent.
And that right there changed my life. So I think whether, you know, it's lower grades or no matter what grades or accent, watch out. Just give someone an opportunity.
I think no better words of advice. Mm-hmm. If you want to lift someone up,
mm-hmm.
look at someone who you may think can't do something for whatever internal bias you have,
mm-hmm.
offer them the opportunity,
mm-hmm.
and expect a lot out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? You will be very pleasantly
mm-hmm.
surprised. So I again want to thank Jose Gonzalez so much for meeting with me today. He's a great friend. You know, we talk about what is a great American, and I believe Jose Gonzalez is a great American. I'll tell you why. A great American is someone who is solid, who plays by the rules, who takes care of their family, who takes care of their community, who works hard, who pays their taxes. That is what makes Americans great, America great, and I'm honored to have him as my friend. Thank you very much for listening to Oregon Crossroads today. Thank you.
That was great.
That's
thank
good.
You.
Thank
that
you.
Was
thank
great.
You.
But that's really what we want. That's good. That's
yeah,
good.
Yeah.
I like that.
It's cool. It's cool you're doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because these little things, they live on.
Yeah, they're going to live way out past me, I hope. I'm going to look back and say, who's that crazy old doctor? Oh, yeah. Those are the issues, and that's what you want to hear. That's,
yeah.
That's very uplifting.
Well,
yeah, with no woe is me.
No.
Yeah.
Well, I know that's why I want you on, because I know there's no woe is me.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, let's talk about it. That's great.
And the great thing about these are that, like you guys were talking earlier about how news is mostly entertainment. It's like, well, when you completely control the medium, the conversation,
right.
There's no outside influences, you can actually get down to the issues and explain things how they should be.
Yeah,
yeah.
Or there's when there's an agenda.
Yeah.
Our agenda is people's success, happiness, and freedom. That's our agenda.
Yep.
How do we get there? What can we do to make it better? That's the only agenda.
Yep.
Have great lives. All right.
It's fun, right? And we're going to do 20 minutes, roughly, give or take a minute or two.
Fair enough.
And then when I put my hand up, I'm not saying stop.
5 minutes.
This will be 5 minutes, and then I'll do three, and I'll do one. All right?
And so what I want to focus on today
do I have anything
is,
in my teeth? You look great.
Is the unaffordability of housing, and really from the rental point of view, because that's the, you know, one thing you can talk about. I think stories are always good, so I want to bring out the story of the Albany story. That's a great story. And how these changes in the law are going to make that not possible to happen, and how again emphasize, and I'll bring it up in my opening remarks, that the government has made housing unaffordable. The government has made housing. It's land, it's fees, it's design build costs. And that's all it is, and that's affordability in a nutshell. And so that'll be opening. Then I'll say a couple of minutes of stuff like that, introduce you, and then I'm just going to let you tell your story about how you're going to be, frankly, prevented. These kinds of laws prevent people like you from building affordable housing and building up neighborhoods. That's really the bottom line. That's why it's no good. It doesn't work. So we're going to try to tell that story.
I have a unique business model.
Mm-hmm.
I buy older, rundown apartments, and I fix them up.
Yep.
And when I get done, they have new bathrooms, new kitchens.
Yeah, you're going to tell all that. That's
yeah.
that what you're going to do.
Remember,
too,
oh,
yeah.
we're not online.
We're not, yeah,
we are going to be...
Oh,
yeah, we're not ready.
So remember,
oh, yeah.
Too,
hey, I'm raring to go.
I can see that.
We're ready. So remember that the camera is the audience. So you're interfacing between...
And we're talking to each other.
Just naturally. Just pretend
yeah.
another person was sitting here. And then you're talking to Bud. So you're kind of toggling back and forth a little
oh,
bit.
Oh, prepare like you're like I'm talking to you, too.
That'd be good.
Yeah,
that'd be good. Because you're that. He's
yeah,
in line. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Okay, let's roll. Ready.
Hi, I'm Dr. Bud Pearson. Welcome to Oregon Crossroads, where we talk about all things free and prosperous. Because when we're free to be who we are and what we are and live the way we want to live, and we're prosperous, life is good. And today, I have a great guest, one of Oregon's finest citizens, Mr. Paul Curley. Paul's
finest.
Finest citizens. And Paul is owner of CPR Incorporated. It's a building company, and it's particularly involved in building affordable apartments, and he'll talk about his business model and how this is so important in our society today. You know, we have a tremendous affordability crisis in our entire housing market, and it's occurred because of government decisions. What we did is 50 years ago, we created strict land use planning laws. We had plenty of land then. A lot of people have moved in. Land is under pressure. Prices go up. So land is unaffordable. Second, we have made the design build requirements exacting and very high level so that the houses have to be really strict insulation standards and other standards in the same manner, and that's very expensive to actually build. And finally, the cities and counties need revenue. They need revenue to operate. And so they, of course, ask the builders to pay their share of the new infrastructure and such, but they go well beyond that, well beyond that. So therefore, you have expensive land, you have expensive fees, and it's expensive to build the projects. And so right now, builders can only build the high-end projects. The high-end projects we can build, but it's very tough to build affordable housing. What we've really done in our society at the present time is build it unaffordable and give a huge subsidy to a few people that can then get into the structure. And that's not going to answer the 150,000 unit shortage that we have in the state of Oregon presently. So Paul Curley has a very interesting business model where he will take dilapidated apartments and bring them up to a high standard and help design great neighborhoods. And this is very important because Oregon had just passed first in the nation, state rent control laws, realizing that up until now, the state of Oregon has blocked local rent control laws because they're so destructive to the housing market. So before, the state said, you can't do it locally, but now we're going to do it across the whole state, and also about evictions and cause and no-cause evictions. And what it's important to know is rent control laws have never improved the amount of housing available and have never lowered the overall cost of units. What it has done is, if you're in a rent-controlled unit, is the cost stays fixed. For everybody else, it goes up. So it's the wrong strategy. So again, that's the introduction, and now I have an expert, a gentleman, again, who's done way more than the people in the political class to prepare and support affordable housing in great neighborhoods, Mr. Paul Curley. So Paul, thank you for coming.
I really appreciate it. And
I want you to start off. I know a lot about you. You're my friend, and we've spoken over the years. But let's talk about the Albany project specifically. That is a project that gets to the heart of what we're talking about.
As a background, Bud, what I am, I call myself a real estate developer landlord. What I am is a landlord. I have a unique business model. I buy low-end apartments, and I fix them up. And I fix them up nice. So you got brand-new kitchens, you got brand-new bathrooms, but the rent is a whole lot lower than something brand new.
Correct.
But in the process of cleaning that up, it's down and dirty, and it's a unique business model because most people don't do it. I'm a landlord. When you talk about the cost of operating projects, half of my operating expenses are taxes. And this is not rent control, but 20% of my operating expenses are property taxes. And then when you add all the other taxes to it, the licenses, the fees, the unemployment. But anyway, I buy run-down stuff. Rent control affects me more than it does just about anybody out there because of the kind of stuff I do. It's run-down. The rents are way low, and generally, when they're really bad, they're full of criminal elements.
Yeah, there's the good people in there and the people that are exploiting them. That's what you find in these rents, whether it be a government project, an old housing project. There are good people that are basically trapped there. They can't get out of there. And you have this bad element that goes in there, and they actually harm the poor people that are living there more than anyone else. And they can't get out, and they know it. And they both know they can't get out, so they're exploited. So those people have to leave.
And with the new law, rent control, the rent part of it doesn't bother me. Are you ready for this? For 10 years, we've had very little rent increases. And in fact, just here recently, the rents were going down until the law went in. I kid you not.
Sure.
You can't make this stuff up.
Sure.
For years, the rents, at first when the recession started in 2008, the rents went down. And then they stabilized. And just for the last couple of years, they made up for it a little bit.
A little bit.
But all of those 10 years, our water, our sewer, our garbage, all those bills kept going up. So we're trying to catch up with where we've been, and we're not there yet. But these people aren't used to rent control, aren't used to rents going up. And then when they suddenly did a bit, they got all excited. So we got a 7% cap right now, and plus another cost of living 10%, we're not competing with each other anymore as a landlord. We're competing with the government. You know we're going to start having a 7 to 10% rent increase every year?
Because you're afraid that if your costs go up dramatically, you can't catch it up. So you can't leave it flat. And if there's some huge 20, 30% run up, you can't do that. You are you can't get behind. You can't afford to get
behind.
Can't afford to get behind.
Are you stealing my thunder?
No.
And it gets worse. Now I got a vacancy. I'm going to float that vacancy out there higher than what I think it's worth for re-rents. Anyway, I buy low-income stuff that's full of a lot of derelicts. No problem. Under the old law, you give them a notice to move. Just move. Under the new law, if they've been there over a year now, and most of these people are entrenched in these older units, I can't tell them to move. I have to force them out. I have to go to court, and I have to tell the judge why they have to move, and I got to prove it. And if there are drug addicts, drug dealers, dealing with all of these drugs, with people coming in every 10, you got to see what some of these runs, every 10 minutes, these people are handing stuff out their windows, and they're looking, this one project in Albany, one-story duplexes, full of these kind of people, they would deal the drugs right out the window, and they'd leer at you, dare you to do something. But every 10 minutes, there's a new car coming in, and all of these people are the same class of people, casing the areas they come, theft everywhere, backyards aren't safe. I have to prove that that guy's doing it.
And that is a very high standard to prove that. And again, I would say that we've gone from allowing people like Paul Curley to make good judgments and decisions, and people always have recourse. It's not like the law isn't there if they really think they're treated unfairly. But to do the right thing and to make the whole project, the whole apartment complex better, making the whole neighborhood better, we've said, no, we don't trust you anymore. We trust the law, we trust process. And I will tell you that a lot of individuals will just wash their hands of it and say, I don't want to do this. I'm not going to be involved in this. I don't care about this. And what you find is when caring landowners who care about the people and what they're developing and about the value of the property, because that is your property.
I respect people and I respect property.
Correct.
And this is a way to do all of that. But when I get a real serious problem, how do I prove that they're doing all this? I need their neighbors. Nobody will testify against these people. And we, as the landlord, have had death threats trying to get these people out.
Correct.
So
the no-cause evictions is a huge deal to you.
Yes.
Huge deal.
The rent control isn't quite what you think it is.
Okay.
But it's a no-cause eviction.
So let's talk about this project. So let's talk about the happiness. This project you did in Albany, made it in the newspapers. Tell the story. Describe what you did and how you uplifted not only that particular project, but that whole neighborhood.
We changed the whole area. I bought 127 units in Albany. Something like 5001 Southwest Boulevard Avenue,
okay.
Albany Meadows now, and it was an absolute slum. It was such a slum that I told the police that we were coming in. We were the new kids on the block. I talked to legal aid, and I told them there's going to be a lot of things happening here, and they were real good about it. And when you drove through this place, my people were used to it. All kinds of one-story duplexes, about 50 buildings. My people looked at me, Paul, are you sure of this? Because of all of the drug addicts, they were right out in the open with it, leering at us. So it took me 2 years and $2 million, but we transformed the place. We got all the drug addicts out, and over the death threats, cars, tires punctured, neighbors punctured. They thought somebody was squealing on them. But if I had it to do over now with a new law, I wouldn't touch the project. It was too far gone, too far down. And I'm sorry about that, but that's the way it is.
Yeah, that is a hard part about it. And getting back to this whole idea of transforming neighborhoods, in this debate of rent control, this isn't so much about no-cause evictions, but there was a recent interesting, I don't remember exactly where I read this, but they talked about San Francisco, and they talked about a place in Massachusetts that had long-standing rent control, and they finally took it off. And it was a tight vote. And it turned out that they looked at the area a few years later, the whole neighborhood area where the rent control is off, and they found that property values, the total net worth of property in that community rose by $2 billion. The whole area property, that was their estimate. So taking the rent control off, $300 million of it was improved value of the apartments. So they became more, because they weren't rent control, so they were worth more. Rents went up a little. Rents did go up a little. But what really happened was that the housing stock around those apartments got $1.7 billion more valuable, because guess what? The apartments weren't run down anymore. And think about what we're talking about doing in Oregon. We're talking about making it illegal to have house-only neighborhoods, because we have a housing crisis. So you're going to be able to put rental apartments everywhere, supposedly. That's a goal of the governor and the speaker of the house, which a lot of us are, there's going to be a lot of pushback, and there needs to be a lot of pushback for a lot of reasons. But guys, do we have the freedom to live in the kind of neighborhoods we want to, and do we get to have local control, or is it the control of the governor and the speaker of the house and whoever else that wants to do it? Do we have that kind of freedom? So there's a lot of pushback. But imagine that if you go into neighborhoods and you build apartments and then you let them go run down, and then what happens when you're the homeowner next door to a rundown apartment? No one wants to buy your house. So your house loses value. So again, what you found in that situation was when you may allow rents to rise appropriately and landowners can put money into them and make them nice and do the hard things that you've done in some of these projects to raise the value, then it improves the value of the apartments and it improves the value of the homes in the neighborhood, so the homeowners are made whole. So again, this whole idea that we're solving a problem with the approach we're taking, which is this idea of rent control, just like if you were around in the oil crisis, gas price control, remember that disaster, that you're ever going to solve that problem. And then, again, you're not going to trust people over process. And how can the law know? How can the law know and get involved? And how can we do it to have people evicted that need to be evicted? And you can say, well, Paul can go to the file a suit or do something like that. I mean, really, he is not in the, Paul Curley and people like him are not in the lawsuit business and the business of the process of evictions. They're there to have the best apartment complex that they can, to take care of the people that are there, that are the good citizens. And if you happen to get a citizen that isn't a good citizen, there has to be a way to remove them so the other people have a good life. Can you imagine the tyranny if you're living in an apartment complex, you have active drug dealers next door, and the owner of the complex feels like there's no reason, can't get them out. Then you have to live with it.
My job as a landlord is to protect my people. My job as a landlord is to protect my tenants. That's a big part of what I do. And this place was so, this is just one example of what I do. It was so run down, under the new law, I wouldn't touch it. And under the new law, I don't believe anybody would that understands the system. The only way that would go is to be so run down that the city or the county would have to come in and condemn it because of all of the criminal elements. They just keep multiplying. They keep multiplying. That's the only answer for the government to close it down and take over. Anyway, I'm on my soapbox.
Okay, but let's talk about now. Let's talk a little bit. So we need to have affordable housing. We need to have houses that are affordable, and we need to have rental units that are affordable. So this is your life. So if I say to you, suddenly you've become the leader, and you're going to put forward ideas to help us create affordable rental housing that will work based on your knowledge and experience, what steps do we need to take to turn this around to get what we want, which is affordable housing? Another thing that makes me incredibly angry is when we do what we have done, we really favor the old over the young, because the young usually have little in the way of assets, so they can't even get into the market. We favor the landowners over the people that don't own land because the value goes so high, it advantages them. And again, people like to talk about helping people that need to be helped, but when you have policies that are harming them, you're doing the opposite. Rhetoric is good, but process, actually doing something to help you, is better. So what do we do in the state of Oregon? If you could, and I know there's a lot of things that are blocking you, but let's just say that you could take those off. What would you say as an apartment person who either rehabilitates or builds units, what would we need to do to make it cheaper, to prepare it so they can translate that savings to lower rents?
For me, with my business model, taking B and C properties, let the market system do its job. Get rid of the no-cause evictions, even the rent controls. Because before, the rents were low until just a couple of years ago. Let the market system work. Let me rehab these properties, because if I'm restricted from doing that, which I am under the new law, I can give a nice, nice affordable housing cheaper than if it's brand new.
Great.
I really, it's a unique approach. Then the other thing, I'm looking to build. Well, the builders are telling me, the experts are telling me, I'm looking at development land. All of this development land has hair on it, has a problem. Well, what's the problem? Well, there's a regulation that says you got a little corner of water, you got a little swamp land, you got a little too much soft soil. And to surmount some of those regulatory issues is almost insurmountable. So this land's just sitting there within the city limits. That's easy to get to. If it was easier to develop, it wouldn't cost as much to build new projects.
So my thing is interesting. When you talk about market, you're really talking about local control. You know, people have used the idea of capitalism and have used that as a bad word. And my idea of capitalism and markets is the local people get to decide. You do get to decide to have more freedom in the projects you can take on, the ones that you can rehabilitate, the ones you can rent for affordable costs. Let the local people decide. So we need to change our language. I'm telling people this, is change it to, do you believe in local control? Do you believe in the people who live in the neighborhood to control?
I'm old-fashioned.
Or do you want the governor and the speaker of the house to decide how things are done? And that's crazy. The other thing I would say is this, is environmentalism is incredibly important to Oregonians. And
to all of us.
And a lot of people are going to push back and say, well, if we don't have all this process, the environment will suffer. My answer to that is this, is in order to create affordable housing, let's take that cost and put it on the general funds budget. In other words, you don't pay anything for that. If there is a mitigation or whatever, we all pay for it. And what that would do is it would let the developers and builders build for low cost, and we would bear the price, and that would allow young people to start. Because a lot of what we do is cost shifted onto the developers, who then put it out there in society, and then only the most affluent can afford to take on the project. Let's let general society bear that cost.
And if we could do that, then as a developer, I'm competing with each other, and we're forcing to keep our rents down because I got to get mine rented before the next guy.
Correct. So we have and what you're hearing is create more supply. So yes. here's really the answer. The answer comes down to trusting people. Trusting people in the trenches of life to do the work. Trust in the goodness of people. If people aren't good, you can't make them good through law. And the reason America has worked and Oregon has worked and our communities have worked is most people are good and want to do the right thing. Trust them to do the right thing. Trust their judgment. And we will have a society of freedom and prosperity. So again, with that, thank you for joining us on Oregon Crossroads, and we'll see you in the future.
There we go. Excellent.
Boy, got me wound up. I have a unique approach.